All right, film study for Ken McCusick. We've got 13 weeks down. The Ravens had a nice victory on Sunday. We're going to talk about in just a moment. So they are now 7-5. Ken McCusick, how are you doing?
Life's good, Josh. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Yesterday the Ravens game was fun, and it was might be the first time this year that I can describe a game as fun.
Oh, if you don't appreciate the shutouts, you weren't having fun during Miami game.
You know what? The shutouts were a lot of fun, and I was hoping and I was hopeful for another one yesterday with the way that first half looked. But you know what? It's the first. How about this? It's the first time that I didn't roll my eyes at the offense.
Okay.
That the offense looked not only like a. The offense has been doing this bit the past couple weeks that I think is perfectly fine, where they're not good, but they don't turn over the ball, and that's been nice. But now they actually looked good as well for a few minutes.
Yeah, it was a very big day for the offense. Obviously, they beat a good Detroit Lions team who still is on the fringe of the NFC playoff hunt at 6-6 as a good quarterback. I mean, all the people who've been complaining about the Ravens not beating a good quarterback, well, this was certainly it, and they beat them very convincingly.
Right, and that's what we got to talk about today is the defense. Like we always do, we do the defense in our first show of the week, and it was really the first, I guess not the first test, but it was a test after the Ravens have become who they are. This is a big test of a good quarterback. And I know lots of people want to say, well, Stafford's not that good of a quarterback, but he's competent. And when you look at the list of quarterbacks we faced this year, tell me one of them that's good besides Ben Roethlisberger.
Yeah, well, Stafford is the best. Roethlisberger is not as good as Stafford and at this point in their careers. And then you also have Mariota they face. They face Dalton. It's not like the Ravens played no good quarterback.
Except,
but I do want to make this point, that the Ravens have won by so much and have held down bad quarterbacks by so much. You really need to take the Ravens' play against those quarterbacks out of their records and then look at those records again, compare them to the league. And I think you find the Ravens were beating bad quarterbacks or any quarterbacks by a lot more than the rest of the league is beating those quarterbacks.
Right, right. And that's definitely something we saw last week with where we crushed Green Bay into a shutout, and then the Patriots struggled with Green Bay. So, or not Patriots, the Steelers. But am I biased to previous years, or are there no more great quarterbacks in the NFL, like a few years ago where we had Tom Brady, Ben Roethlisberger, Andrew Luck, Peyton Manning, all these guys at the top of their game, and I have trouble listing great quarterbacks in the NFL today.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely been some younger quarterbacks that haven't worked out. Derek Carr is not really having the season everybody would have hoped he would have, but Wentz is good and Goff is good. It's just that some of them are now in the NFC, I guess.
And Geno Smith. all right, so that was the fun part of yesterday's game, and we're going to dig really deep into the fun, but let's get the bad out of the way. Jimmy Smith went down hurt. Now, which is worse, Jimmy Smith going down hurt for the year, or today's news of Jimmy Smith being suspended for 4 games for PED use?
I mean, obviously both are very bad, and even though Jimmy can serve the suspension while he's hurt.
Oh, he can?
Yes.
All right, that's news to me. I did not understand that. Good job, Jimmy. Way to hide that test until you went down.
Well, he apparently was appealing it, and he's now going to drop his appeal. Now, if he truly was not guilty, it might still be worth it to appeal and then try and make sure that the black mark is expunged. But given the fact that he's got 4 games right now where he can not hurt the Ravens by being out.
Right, he's out for the season. It's a 4-game suspension. There's 4 games left in the season.
In a way, it really kind of fits.
Right.
But, I want to look past this. Obviously, the Ravens have had some PED issues. They really need to figure out what's going on around the organization and how can they reduce or restrict this from happening. It's just happening all over the place, and that's upsetting.
Yeah, it's something that baseball dealt with a few years ago, and NFL has always had this issue, and it doesn't get the limelight, I guess, that baseball had with it.
Right. Well, it's such a big competitive advantage in the NFL, and apparently there's all kinds of people trying to do various things. They have a lot of very strict rules on what you have to do in order to get something approved before you take it. You know, you're the responsible as the player for whatever goes inside your body, yada, yada. So It's a lot to get through, but there's still way too many suspensions. The Ravens need to figure out how to get their players not in the program.
Right, but there's millions of dollars on the line, so there will always be people trying to skirt the line in order to get that extra million.
That's right.
But let's forget about the PED. Let's talk about this injury and where the Ravens go from here, because Humphrey went in for Jimmy Smith after he went down.
That's right. So, you know, the nice news from this is that the Ravens have the deepest secondary they've ever had. They literally have 10 guys that are plus, to the relative to the replacement level at least, players who are on the roster right now. They dropped to 9 with Jimmy Smith, but 9 is all they ever activated. So they were deactivating Hill, for example, in this situation. Right. So the way I look at it is one position at a time. So if you start at outside corner and you look that now Humphrey and Carr are the guys, who's next up if something happens to one of those two? And I think the Ravens have an answer. I think they'd move Kennedy to the outside, which is probably his more normal position. Kennedy's played great in the slot, but he has the length to play outside corner, and it would be nice to see him adapt to that where he would be more valuable, I believe.
And then does that move Hill up?
And that would, yeah, you'd move Hill up to take over some slot corner duties and maybe share them with Webb, or maybe Hill takes over. You know, you have multiple options there still, even after you move Kennedy to the outside. And then slot corner. So Hill would be next man up if something happened to either Webb or Kennedy. But, you know, they might decide they wanted to move Webb to another position. Then you have Hill. Then you have Hill. Or they might decide they need to move Kennedy. Again, you have Hill. So you have another guy at slot corner either way.
All right. Well, that's good to hear. That was my first thought when it happened was Jimmy Smith is having an amazing year, so that's not the guy I wanted to lose. But if you're going to lose a guy in a position, that's a pretty safe spot for the Ravens as far as depth goes. It's not Ronnie Stanley going down. It's not Brandon. Mosley. It's not Mosley. It's not Williams. It's not these guys that are – really, really tough to replace.
Yeah, I mean, Mosley and Stanley would be the two most significant losses right now. And if you really think about it and put them in a relative sense, the analogy I use is that the loss of Mosley or Mosley or Stanley is Pompeii, and the loss of Jimmy Smith in a relative sense is the Springfield tire fire. It's not that he's not a great player. He is. But just in terms of how much it impacts the team based on how good the replacement is and how good the depth still remains, you know, that's the difference in terms of what happens to your team.
Okay. So you're not worried about a big regression team-wide because of this one move?
I'm really not. I think they're covered at strong safety with Clark. I think they're covered at free safety with Webb if something were to happen to Weddle. I think they're covered at dime because Clark played fairly well in this last game and got additional chance. So I think they've got replacements everywhere. I'm really not concerned that the secondary is going to take a step down from this move. Not a big one anyway.
Okay, that's good to hear. I am going to miss Jimmy Smith. He is one of the few guys left from that Super Bowl run, so it would be nice to have him in there. But it is exciting that we do have some of these young guys and can work out okay.
Yep.
So let's talk about these guys, and let's talk about yesterday's game, and let's start with the pass rush.
Okay, well, you can talk about the pass rush first if you like. The Lions were effective throwing the ball for 7.9 yards per play. But if you look at what Pease did, Pease really tried to do a lot of things in terms of generating pressure. He was fairly effective doing so. The Ravens were fairly effective doing so. They allowed Stafford ample time on space on just 14 of 37 dropbacks. That's 38%. And we kind of have to remind people that 50% is about normal, so 38% is pretty good. Unfortunately, a lot of those were ball-out quick situations, 11 of the 23. So the Ravens didn't actually generate the pressure, but it looked like the pocket might have broken down, but Stafford unloaded before it became a problem. So that was what that's the differentiation there. But still, those throws tend to not be as long or not be as big yard gainers. Looking at variation of scheme, the Ravens had 6 pass rushes that qualified as deceptive by my definition. They had 12 blitzers they said that were from off the line of scrimmage. And we've been talking about this in recent weeks. They've had 2 and 3 in some games. Well, 12 is a lot for one game, and that's especially for only 37 throws, not 50 throws. So it's a lot, and Pease was really trying to manufacture pressure in this game. Additionally, he rushed 6 4 times, 7 1 time. They'd only used the 6-man pressure, 6-man or more pressure, 18 times all season. So they'd been successful with it, but to see it used five times in this game is impressive. It did not work in this game, well, not much. They ran 4 6-man pressures, and they had 13.5 yards per play on those plays. But then you also look at they had a sack and a turnover on those plays as well. So, you know, you take some good with your bad. And that's what really happened is the pressure didn't reduce the Lions' yardage. It created turnovers, and all three turnovers came off a generated pressure. One was by Weddle, obviously, and the other two, there was a pressure by Smith that led to the interception by Humphrey.
Humphrey got one as well. Yes.
Humphrey. And then there was Kennedy's quarterback hit, which led to the pick six by Weddle. So all of those involved some form of pressure being generated against Stafford. So Pease had the right idea, and he was able to get his players to execute several times to make it happen.
And that's the big story for the Ravens this year is that turnover percentage.
Oh, yeah, for the defense.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the defense turnovers way outnumber what this offense has given up.
Oh, yeah, 20 interceptions leads the entire National Football League at this point, and they have the most takeaways as well, and they're on a great turnover run now, so I guess they've been 6-0 in the last couple of weeks. I forget what they were at Green Bay, but we could look that up. But there you go, they're on a great turnover
run
at this
yes.
point.
Yes, they are. 7.9 yards per pass when Stafford did successfully get the ball out. Is that concerning that it's that long, that's almost 8 yards, or is that kind of the way the Ravens play with that soft secondary?
It's a high-risk, high-reward scheme. So, you know, they had some big plays they gave up, particularly by Humphrey in this game. Gave up 2 40-plus plays and another one of 23 yards. One of them was a really perfectly thrown ball. No problem there. The Ravens even had good coverage on the play. It's just the ball was dropped in perfectly to Ebron, or I think it was Roberts, actually, who caught that one. But then the two longer ones that are over 40 yards were both to Marvin Jones, and those two were ones where Humphrey ran himself out of position and really had a chance at the ball. So it's unfortunate that it worked that way. I don't think it's a long-term problem for Humphrey, and we'll get to that a little later in terms of what's happening with him and how he played in this game.
All right. Well, before we get to the details and really look at some specific players, let's talk about the run defense, because that keeps getting better each week, it seems.
Yeah, so a few weeks ago, remember, the Ravens had the worst run defense in all of football,
right,
which was never really true. They gave up a lot of yards on the ground, largely because other teams were grinding out the clock on them in part. And
the offense wasn't doing anything, so they spent a lot of time on the field.
There you go. There you go. So certainly the Steelers was way to get a rack of 170 yards with a power run game, because that's what they could do against
right.
the Ravens. So, but anyway, they held the Lions to 78 yards on 24 carries, and now it's 5 weeks. The Ravens have allowed just 335 rushing yards on 114 carries, and that works out to 2.9 yards per carry. So any of you people who are still concerned about where the Ravens rank in terms of yardage allowed to the run, I'm going to tell you not to worry at all at this point. The Ravens' run defense is alive and well, and I would be surprised if they go from this point where they are right now, and they're at about 3.9 yards per carry, to allow 4 yards per carry for the first time in franchise history. So, good spot for the Ravens to be right now.
Right, because we got the Steelers, Bengals, Browns, the Steelers,
yeah.
And the Colts in there. So those aren't teams that you hope aren't going to push it that far up. You mentioned the Steelers, and we played them in Week 4.
Mm-hmm.
This Ravens team is different and healthy now. What does that mean that we can expect from that run defense? We're not giving up 170 yards on the ground again, right, this week?
I let's say I sure hope not. That would be really bad. A lot of things would tell you it'll be difficult. The first is the Steelers are going to be coming off a Monday night game, and I think that may make them a little bit more tired and weary on both lines potentially, but certainly the offensive line is a possibility they'll be a little dinged up. The Ravens didn't have Brandon Williams the last time, and they lost that run game in a lot of ways. They lost eligible receiver blocks. They lost on the edge some. But most importantly, from my point of view, was the Ravens were not able to stop the Steelers from pulling by getting penetration in the center of the line. And Brandon Williams was missing, and that was the biggest reason for it. So you see all of these easy combination blocks being made by the Steelers up front, allowing DeCastro to pull from left to right, for a tight end to pull from right to left. It makes you miserable just to watch the thing, but I don't expect that Brandon Williams is going to allow that to happen this time, nor will Pierce when paired with him.
So you're not going to watch the week four game this week to prepare?
No, I'm going to let it ride.
leave that to Dev to rewatch for his game plan or battle plans.
Yeah, we need to get Dev on. That was a really good show last week, and we need to try and get him on again when we can.
Yeah. No, that would be that'd be great. All right. Well, that's exciting, and we always worry about the Ravens overlooking whoever they play before the Steelers, because that game gets so much hype, and it's good for the Ravens that the week before the Steelers tonight have to play the Bengals, so they're not overlooking that game. They've got a tough couple of weeks that hopefully we can squeeze one out of them.
Right. It's a very big, and then they play the Patriots the following week. So it's
right.
The Ravens, Steelers fans are officially scared if they lose this game to the Bengals tonight. They might try and act tough, but they're officially scared because they've got they'll have the Ravens coming up. The Ravens have looked like a completely different team. If the Ravens go in there and win, and they all know that the history between the Ravens and Steelers is for close games, then the division is very much in the balance.
Right.
And they could lose it with the game against New England. So,
right. Let's get to that. A bunch of questions on Twitter were coming in today about that whole tiebreaker situation
and
the Ravens' playoffs chances. So we'll get to that at the end of the show, because suddenly, a couple weeks ago, you know how it goes. Everyone was negative and fire Harbaugh, fire, get rid of Flacco, this, that. I think we all still agree to get rid of Marty, but we can put that on hold for now.
Uh-huh.
And now all of a sudden we feel like we're in the driver's seat for this playoff position. And yesterday I even mentioned to some people that, man, if the Steelers lose to the Bengals, we've got a shot for the division. And people laughed at me. But if the Steelers lose to the Bengals tonight, things get really interesting in the next few weeks.
Yeah, they do. And unfortunately, they get interesting in some difficult ways, too, if the Steelers lose to the Bengals. So it might be better for the Ravens' wild card chances. In fact, it definitely is better for the Ravens' wild card chances if the Bengals lose this game. But because it's so much better for the divisional chances, and because the divisional chance is worth so much in terms of getting a home game, I still think it's worth it for the Ravens to have the Bengals win tonight.
Right. And, well, yeah, because you're not the type of guy who's like me who's going to be rooting for injuries. That will be what I root for tonight. Knowing that I never want the Steelers to win helps me cheer for the Bengals tonight. But come on, I'm really rooting for injuries.
Getting each team a little banged up is the normal amount to root for. So
okay,
we don't want to have a completely unfatigued Pittsburgh team to play on Sunday. Let's put it that way.
Right. I want some sore ribs, maybe a little hesitation there. Come in soft. That's what I'm hoping for next week. So whatever you got to do to bang them up. But I, you know what? I want Ben Roethlisberger still in the game, because Steeler backup quarterbacks tear us apart.
Yeah, they have at times. They certainly have not won all the time, and that's one of the complaints the Steelers have, is that, you know, the Ravens always get to play the Steelers' backup quarterback, and so none of the records count, ever.
Right.
But Steelers fans have the funniest thing. I mean, I'm not saying the Ravens don't do it, too. As an organization, if you look at the Ravens media guide, everything began in the year 2000. Okay, stop doing that. Okay, it's so stupid to do that. Start in 1996, live with the first 4 years. The Ravens still lead, for example, in shutouts since the Ravens first came into the league with 13. Don't try and make everything since 2000. Not home record, not any of that crap. I really don't appreciate it. I don't like it, and it makes us look weak and stupid. And the Steelers have been doing it forever, because the Steelers organization, if you talk to any Steelers fan, did not even begin until the Steel Curtain arrived.
Right.
Before they first made their playoff appearance in 72, which is like 40 years into the organization's history, nothing counts. And that's always been amusing to me, too.
Right, right. The Baltimore Orioles started 5 years ago, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Let's get back to this game and the dime defense, because we saw more of the dime yesterday, and that continues to work for Dean Pease.
Oh, boy. So, yeah, that's one thing I've been critical about for years. We're not going to go rehash that, because we've heard it all before.
Right.
He
finally came around to your type of thinking. You convinced him.
Anyway, 24 dime snaps out of 61 versus the Lions. And for the first time this year, the dime was the plurality defense, meaning they played it more than any other defense, but still not 50% of the time. Okay?
Yep.
So anyway, they only allowed 4 yards per play in the dime, but 6.1 overall. I didn't actually try and look at it separately to see, but it's probably around over 8 yards per play anyway, maybe 8.5, with non-dime defenses. So okay. It made all the difference for the Ravens to do that. And they got all three sacks and all three turnovers with the dime on the field. Chuck Clark and Anthony Levine split the duty. So we can talk a little bit about that later. We can talk about it now. Maybe now is better, actually.
Yeah, let's take care of it.
Okay, so Anthony Levine played 17 snaps, and he was outstanding. And I'll make sure I have the number correct here. Yes, Anthony Levine played 17 snaps, and against Detroit, he had, I want to get this out because I want to get it right, they ran the ball for 0.8 yards per play and passed for 2.5 yards per play when he was in, for 2.1 overall. Okay, so that's in a game where Detroit was getting 6.1 yards per play. With Levine on the field, it was only 2.1 yards per play. Now, that's the package doing it, but Levine is making outstanding individual contributions as well. In this game, he had several of those. If you want to go and look play-by-play, I've got more information out on the website, and that'll allow you to go through with Game Pass and do it at the same time. So we don't go play-by-play at this. Clark also came in, and he played 9 snaps. Not every one of those were dime. I believe it was 7 dime snaps and then 2 on the back end at safety also on that last drive. Now, they didn't do as well on a yards per play basis, but Clark made some good plays himself, including getting a big pressure, which allowed Suggs then to clean up with his sack. So that was a very nice individual contribution he made, and I'm excited to see what he can do, and I think he's one of the options for the Ravens have to replace Levine in the dime when Levine finally can't do it anymore or if Levine gets hurt. So exciting to have two players able to do the job.
That's exciting. Yeah, definitely. All right, let's get to the players, and here's where we pick out just a few guys to talk about and how they did. And let's start with Austin Henry.
Well, it's Willie Henry we're talking about here. Yeah, Austin Howard on the offense, but that's cool.
Why would I pay attention?
He played 42 snaps in this game, and he is just the Iron Man now of this defensive line. So he was the kid nobody wanted last year, did not get activated for a single game, and was IR'd midway through the year. Then this year, he was deactivated for the first 2 games before he finally started playing. So he's only dealing right now with a 10-game career, and he's already the Ravens' Iron Man in terms of snaps. So the Lions, because they played so much dime, and also because there were a lot of other passing situations where the Ravens had two defensive linemen on the field in the nickel, Willie Henry played an awful lot of snaps in this game. So he played 42, and he made contributions all over the place. I'm sure you saw he scooped the forced fumble from Weddle on Weddle's sack and picked that up and ran it back 16 yards. He had a nice bull to blow up a run play. That's midway through the second quarter. I got times in the article if you want to go check this out. He had a beautiful sniff out on a screen pass where he took down Riddick for a loss of 4. I love that one. And then he delivered a quarterback hit on Stafford as he was throwing the game-sealing interception to Humphrey. And I mentioned Smith had a pressure earlier on that play, but then Henry delivered the knockout blow as the ball was thrown and also hurt Stafford's hand and knocked him out of the game. So very imposing player at this point already. And he's only in his second year. You can get very excited. If you're buying a jersey, think Willie Henry. He's one of the good choices. Marlon Humphrey is too, but Willie Henry is another good one.
All right. You got Rickard here in your notes. I didn't even realize he had a snap this week. We're going to talk about him on Wednesday because he got his first touchdown. But he's been on the offensive side of the ball for many weeks.
Yes. So he hadn't played an offensive snap since October 15th. He came in for the last play of the game to play on the defensive line. He did the same thing at Cincinnati in the opener. He just played 1 snap. I think they just kind of want to maybe remind him, or he wants to, you know, have a defensive snap every once in a while to remind the other people that he can still play the defensive line. But one thing about Rickard is he looks smaller to me now than he did before. He's a still effective blocker, but he looks like he might have trimmed down to maybe about 285, 288 pounds, and he doesn't really weigh 300 anymore. So he's a big, thick guy, obviously, but he's just not the enormous guy he was when he was trying to be a nose tackle.
All right. Is Bowser improving, I hope?
Yeah, 10 snaps in this last game. So he hasn't had 10 snaps in too many games.
All right, coming out of that doghouse.
Yeah, coming out of that doghouse. And he had 2 really nice plays. So he flushed Stafford from the pocket, and that was the play where he drove him out of the pocket and he had to run out of bounds because Levine forced him out a yard beyond the line of scrimmage. Effectively, that's a sack for a gain of 1. That's the way to think of that.
Okay.
It's certainly not what they wanted. It's just a sack for a gain of one, so it's not technically a sack. So, but anyway, very good play there. The other was he drew a holding call on Decker with 30 seconds left in the half. Actually, I think it might have been 28 seconds. Suggs took Stafford down for another sack plus one on that play. Same exact situation. He was driven out of the pocket, and Suggs took him down. But you can't underestimate or understate the value of the option that the Ravens had from that holding call. So if they had completed a play, even if it's 50 yards, well, it's coming back for the holding call. If they needed it, they would have had it. So anyway, it's one of the reasons why I charge offensive linemen pretty heavily on penalties, because they can be declined, and if they can, then they have they can give the other team significant option value in terms of, think of it as giving them a free play.
All right. Well, that works. Judon, he was, again, he's starting to become my favorite guy to watch on the field, because he plays hard. He got a sack. How'd Judon do?
Yeah, so he got a fairly fast sack driving right by the right tackle on the play. He also drew a holding call that was on Robinson, and that would have been his second sack of the game because he was there. And then he had a PD in the backfield, which was also a nice play, but it got negated when Henry roughed the passer. So Henry, I think it probably was a fair roughing the passer call. He ran into him late. He didn't put his head into him, and
he
didn't go low,
up.
but he hit him a little late.
Yeah. All right. Mosley scared us when he went down for a little bit and went in the concussion protocol.
Yeah, so I thought it was the ankle. Concussion protocol is bad, obviously. Either is bad. Any potential missed time for Mosley is terrible. Right now, though, I'm telling you, even though the Ravens would drop so much in terms of the quality of play without Mosley, Mosley himself is not making enough plays. I've got him in my notes, and I know a lot of his value comes in coverage, so you know some of the value I'm not seeing before I look at the all 22 footage. So when I look at that, I'll see that he was in great coverage and he was a lot of the reason why, you know, Stafford couldn't get rid of the ball on time or whatever. But what I'm seeing is more he's getting beaten coverage a couple different times, or two times in this game, or that he's getting blocked on run plays and is unable to get off those. And that's something earlier in his career when Suggs named him half man, half amazing. And now he still calls him amazing. He's not making as many of those plays this year, and he's kind of having a down year. I haven't talked about him in my article for several weeks because I've been trying to, you know, watch and hope it'll get better and whatnot, but it's very concerning.
Well, especially when it's a guy who we need him to be the next Ray Lewis.
There you go. I mean, he's the glue that holds the defense together, and even playing at just a mediocre level like he is, he's still that. And the Ravens would lose tremendously if he wasn't there, but you're right. I mean, he's their defensive signal caller. And one thing Bill James used to say is, it's generally not a good thing when your leadership comes from players who are not performing at the highest level. So he'd say the best leadership comes from the best players.
Right, right. Speaking of the best players, can we get on and stop talking about maybe Terrell Suggs is retiring? He's playing some outstanding football.
He's just, you keep looking at the calendar and trying to figure out what the hell is this guy doing still on a football field at his age. But he had five tackles against the run, five tackles, period. And they weren't little tackles. The gains were 2-0, 2-1, and minus 8 in terms of yardage. So there were significant tackles in this game. He had a holding call that he drew, and he denied a conversion at the end of the first half that we already talked about. So great game from Terrell Suggs. I actually think I'm wrong on the holding call. I think that was in the previous game that he did that. So I don't want to improperly credit that. But that was against the Texans. But still, great game for Terrell.
All right. And then you mentioned earlier that the Ravens are going to have to rely on Kennedy.
Sure.
Do you want to expand on how he's been playing?
Absolutely. So he's been playing in the slot, and Webb and he are each getting some snaps, and it looks like Webb usually plays in the nickel and Kennedy comes in the dime. But then after a certain point in the game, they're just playing Kennedy all the time in the slot. So he got 35 snaps, which is career high in this last game. They were all at slot corner. He played all 24 of the dime snaps, and the Ravens allowed just 4 yards per play when he was in, which is coincidentally the amount that they gave up during the dime. He didn't give up any significant pass plays personally, And one of the big turning points that people don't look at was early in this game. The Ravens led this game just 3-0. Mosley was taken off the field. And so the Ravens were playing with Correa and Owosu at inside linebacker on a third and 10 play. And they rushed both of them. I'm sorry, it was Owosu and Levine. I'm sorry, Correa and Levine who were on the field. So they rushed both of them as part of a six-man rush package. And that left Kennedy all alone in a wide open space with Golden Tate. And he stayed with him and took him down for only 2 yak to deny that conversion. The Ravens then, the Lions then missed the field goal, and the Ravens turned it around and drove for a touchdown. And that ended up being really the turning point in the game. Ravens are up 10-0, and the Ravens this year have never lost a lead of more than 3 points. So it looked that 10-0 lead was feeling pretty good at that point.
All right. Speaking of leaving guys in the back, I was surprised to see Carr up front on some of these run stops.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, because Carr came to the team over the offseason without a real pedigree as a physical run stuffer. And by the way, that's the reason Carr has been able to stay on the field all these years. He basically has never missed a start. It's basically because he doesn't involve himself in the run game. And McAllister was the same way, but we saw him have two very good run stops in this game, one in Q1, one in Q3 for gains of 0 and 2. And he also had good coverage on two of the long throws down the right sideline. So he still is a good boundary defender in that regard. So there are two of them. They're both in quarter one. Times are out there on the website. Please take a look. I didn't make one negative note about Carr the entire game. So I look through and Maureen and I probably write down about 60, 70 things about the game as we're going through, but there wasn't one negative note about Carr.
That's all right. Good. I guess we can transition with negative notes. And Humphrey seemed to really struggle until he got that interception at the end. And then, did he redeem himself?
Well, he certainly redeemed himself at the interception. That sealed the game. So anything that happened previously, it was all his demerits are wiped out for that.
All right.
But in truth, Humphrey had a pretty good game even without that. He did miss a tackle early on, and that's something that you don't want to see. But the three long plays, one of them was really dropped in the bucket, and he couldn't have done anything about it, and that was the throw to Roberts. But he also gave up those two long plays where he's out of position. We talked about that earlier, so I don't feel like I need to go into that again. And then he also had great bracket coverage with Weddle, so he was on the underneath side when Weddle got that near pick on the back of the end zone where he couldn't get his feet down. Okay, so that was a good play. He had another nice play where he took down Jones for a gain of one on a, I guess you'd call it a swing pass on the left side. He hung on for dear life, and that guy eventually help arrived and flattened him. But very nice play there by Humphrey.
Right. You mentioned Weddle couldn't get his feet down on that interception, but he got another interception in like pretty open field.
Yeah. So it was a weird situation because you remember the play. Kennedy came off the slot by blitz, delivered a quarterback hit to the court just as the ball was thrown. And the ball was thrown up in a completely open space on the field. It's almost like he intended it, and it was Rudock in the game at that point, intended it to be intentional grounding.
Okay.
But somehow, all of a sudden, Weddle's over there in a spot in the field where there's nobody within 15 yards of him. And so I think two things might have happened. One is he read the quarterback's eyes and figured out he's going to throw it away, so he got to the spot. The other thing is I think he read the quarterback hit and said, he might leave it short. Let me be here. And he was just in the perfect spot to collect that ball directly. I've never seen anything like it in terms of somebody being that far from anybody else and getting an interception. Especially, you know, you occasionally see a center fielder making a play like that where the quarterback thinks he's overthrown everybody and the center fielder is back there to take it. But just in a relatively short area, you know, off to the right side, it's very weird. And obviously he went right in for six, and that closed the scoring, and it sent everybody home happy.
All right. Let's get to our defensive MVPs. And I'll start with my number three is I'm giving it to Dean Pease because I thought he called a really good game defensively, and I'd like seeing more dime in there.
Yeah, outstanding game from Dean. Can't agree more. And I think that he gets a lot of flack in the media. There are some things I would like to see done a little bit differently, but the big one is being done differently this year, and that's that he's playing lots of dime. And he is not trying to do this. And I hope that in future years he won't go back to the dime, even if they have a linebacker they think can cover a little bit. But anyway, we are where we are. I'm just soapboxing on that. My number three guy, Maurice Kennedy. terrific game here. I mean, it was really a juggling match to figure out where Kennedy should belong, whether he should be 1, 2, or three in this game. I finally decided on number three.
All right. My number two, I'm giving it to Humphrey because of that game-sealing interception. I have concerns that Ben Roethlisberger is going to take advantage of him a little bit, but hopefully now a week preparing, he'll be okay.
Well, you know what? Humphrey's played so well this year. I don't have any fear about where he's going to be. I didn't include him in my top three, but I agree that I think it could really be an asset against Roethlisberger. And if Roethlisberger decides he wants to pick on Humphrey, I think Humphrey could pick him as well.
All right.
So I have Terrell Suggs as my number two guy. Big game again, and 10.5 sacks now in 12 games. It boggles the mind. One of the good things, if the Ravens make the playoffs, Suggs is either a sack or a sack and a half short. I think it's a sack. Short of Willie McGinnis for the all-time playoff sack record. It'd be really nice to see him get that.
All right. I think there's a good chance he'll get that, but we'll see. My number one is Willie Henry, simply for the fact that I love to see big guys run with the football.
Yeah. You know what? We heard that crap last year, remember, when Harbaugh was upset with Jernigan.
Right, because he didn't just fall.
Plays the same position. Because he didn't just fall on the ball, and he ran into the end zone, and then he ran it out, and then he fumbled against the Jets, and that cost us the ball game, or it might have cost us
right.
the ball game.
But when it works, everyone cheers.
But when it works, everyone cheers. And, you know, it's, don't take it. A nice shot. So, yeah, we live where we are. So, anyway, Eric Weddle, my number one guy. Involved in two turnovers, great bracket coverage on the back end. He nearly had an interception in the end zone. And then he also nearly had an interception when Humphrey made the pick. Humphrey kind of took it away from him by drifting backwards from bracket coverage and making that play. So it could have been a three-pick game for Weddle if everything had gone just right there.
All right. Now it's mailbag time. And we got a few questions here before we get to the playoff tiebreakers situation. First one comes in from BMD, who says, Ken, is there any scope to bring Tyrod? Oh, that's an old one. I meant to read the top one. I'm guessing, no, that's last week. There he is. I knew I had one from him. His question is not as good as the previous questions he asked. It is, does Josh regret his Bowser jersey purchase after he whiffed on an easy sack? He really whiffed on that play. I thought he was getting that sack, and he whiffed. I don't regret it yet, but there are some other guys I wish I spent money on their jerseys instead.
All right, so who would you buy instead at this point? If they'd let you trade your Bowser jersey in, who would you get?
I think Humphrey's a good one.
Okay.
Right now. I don't know. We don't know how long Jimmy Smith is sticking around, and Humphrey's the future there, it appears.
Good call.
All right. Has Patrick Osweiler earned these to start next to Mosley beyond this season, or should the Ravens consider that position a mid to high priority need this offseason? This is from Dustin Cox.
Right. So great question, Dustin. And I'll tell you where I see it. I think the Ravens must draft an inside linebacker next year for a lot of reasons. But they really cannot afford to have the thinness of depth that they have, even if Owosu is their guy, to start next year. So I don't have any round specificity to that, but it wouldn't bother me if they went as high as the second or third round. I would prefer if they did not use their first round pick on a linebacker. But if best player available is, you know, the great inside linebacker, and that's who drops to them at number 32, we hope, then by all means, pick that linebacker.
Right. Yeah, they always do that best player available. So, Minion Hunter asks, with the open-ends of prime GM slots this year, is there any chance that Eric leaves? And I guess Eric DaCosta?
That's right. So there's been talk about that for years, and I think there are a couple things going on. One is that Eric is married, I believe, to a doctor who locally. And so, you know, it's a two-income household and whatnot. But beyond that, DaCosta was given a big salary bump by Bisciotti, who's very good at managing talent. And the idea is his not official title, but his official status in the organization is general manager in waiting. So I think he'd be foolish to actually take the extra risk to be a general manager somewhere else, you know, when he's got a lot of the benefits salary-wise here and will also get it at some point when Ozzie leaves. So I think I like the chances to keep Eric for next year.
Yeah, and the Ravens make it clear that they value him and have promised him that job title at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Rob McDonald asks, why did Harbs put Rickert in for reps on D at the end of the game this week. Rickert seems like an offensive weapon that you'd want to keep focused on playing halfback. Is there any value in flip-flopping him?
That's a really good question, Rob. I mean, value, probably not. I mean, my guess is Rickard probably wanted to play a little bit more on defense. The risk comes for the Ravens when they get an injury on the defensive line against a team that likes to run the ball. And then they will only have five guys active, including Rickard, on the defensive line. So they'll be down to four, and they can't give every single snap to the other three guys. They're going to have to rely on him to play some. And that's exactly what happened against the Bears in week six when he got 19 snaps, is that they got an injury. I think it was Carl Davis early in that game went out, and they had to have somebody else come in and pick up some snaps because the Bears were running two back sets the whole game. So Rickard played significantly. So that's what they want him for, is that emergency usage on the defensive line.
Okay. And who knows, maybe he's a guy who he likes to be out there on that defensive side of the ball. And when he's obviously, they're giving him a game ball because he scored his first touchdown. So you let him have some fun when the game's out of hand, and go ahead. You can get some time out there.
Sure thing.
All right, let's get to these tiebreakers. We talked about tonight's Monday Night Football, which for many people, after they listen to this, they'll know whether or not the Steelers won or the Bengals won. So let's talk about these tiebreaker scenarios that might be an issue for the Ravens.
Sure. Do you have some specific? Was there a specific question that came up on the
topic?
Talk about it a little bit.
I know that you have an article out on Russell Street Report, so I thought you could catch us up on that, because my understanding is that if the Ravens continue to win, they're in the playoffs.
First of all, let's start with, if the Ravens go 11-5, they're guaranteed to be in the playoffs. If the Ravens go 10-6, they're in the playoffs, except for one bizarre and incredibly unlikely scenario involving the Buffalo Bills. So it's not even worth worrying about.
So if the Bills win out as well. So
the Bills would have to win out, and then it would have to fall to strength of victory, and the Ravens would have to... No, the Bills would have to win out. The Ravens would have to have a specific loss.
Okay.
The Ravens have to beat Pittsburgh and then lose to one of the common opponents, which means they have to lose to either Cincinnati or to Indianapolis. But beat the Steelers. So it's very unlikely that combination of things would happen.
Right.
And if that did, then they could lose a tiebreaker to Buffalo at 10-6.
Okay.
And the only way they lose a tiebreaker anyway beyond that is it has to go to strength of victory. So anyway, we don't need to spend any more time on that. But there are a host of teams involved. What I'll say is basically this. Don't worry about 10-6. The Ravens are definitely in. Worry about 9-7, because that's the place where tiebreakers are going to matter. And there are a number of teams involved in the tiebreaker hunt at 9-7, and basically Miami can get there, but there's about roughly a 0% chance of it happening. If they do get there, they don't have head-to-head against the Ravens. You know what I'm going to do? This is material that really is not well suited to go through individually, team by team. What I'd like people to do is go online and look at the thing. I'll leave you with this, though. The Ravens to increase their wild card hopes want the Bengals to lose tonight. The Ravens to increase their divisional hopes want the Steelers to win tonight.
Division.
Did I say that wrong?
If the Bengals win, we have a shot at the division. If the Steelers win, we have a good shot at the wild card.
That's right. What you said, and then we'll talk about the other. Situation. I hopefully let you read it, because it's extremely complex in terms of how the tiebreakers work, online on my article, and it involves all but four of the AFC teams. There's only four teams that are out at this point, and the rest are still in the game.
All right, and the truth is, it really comes down to ask me next week, because what the Steelers do tonight and what the Ravens and Steelers do on Sunday night are big things about how this season's going to play out.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I also want to tell people, If that's your attitude, please don't read my tiebreaker article, because my tiebreaker article is for people who want to understand what are all the possibilities now and not defer the decision making. So
Go read the article, because I want to know what it is now. But it's normal football. As each week goes on, we can cross more things off those options.
That's true. And then we may have to, unfortunately, expand down to strength of victory. Right now, I've only covered the top three.
Strength of victory gets confusing, and let's hope it doesn't come down to strength of victory.
Indeed. Let's hope for that.
But I bet those shutouts would help with strength of victory.
It's dependent upon how many wins your opponents had. So it's that you beat. So that's what strength of victory is.
Okay, gotcha. All right, Ken. People should go on over to Russell Street Report and read that article. You also have your breakdown for the defense up right now.
Yes, it's out there now, and so the podcast will have this out tomorrow, and hopefully you'll download it and take it to work, and also subscribe. What else should they do, Josh, about the podcast?
Write us a review on iTunes. Subscribe, tell your friends, write us a review. It's three simple things, and follow us on Twitter at Film Study Ravens and at Josh Soroka, and just keep spreading the word. We're having a lot of fun doing this. It's growing, and it's exciting to see it grow.
Yeah, it sure is. I didn't realize how many downloads we had, but Josh showed me how to look at that last week, and very happy.
Yeah, we've got a contingency that really intrigues me at the Cherry Point Marine Base down in North Carolina.
And at Cherry Point, thanks for listening.
Yeah, and send me a message, because I'm really intrigued by who's down there listening. Because someone is, and my brother-in-law is stationed down there, and he doesn't know anyone down there who's listening. But I know someone is, and it's not him.
Yeah, we'd love to have your mailbag question down from Cherry Point, too, especially.
Yeah, send me a message. All right, and then my show is Section 336, Baltimore Sports Talk. This week we'll talk a little bit about the Orioles and their soft, quiet offseason. A lot of people upset with Dan Duquette, but he has signed a bunch of minor league pitchers, so he's done a little bit something that we'll talk about. As well as we'll talk about the Ravens victory, a little more lighthearted than when you and I really dig into it. So we'll probably focus more on Flacco eating the W, and that's about the creepiest video I've ever seen on the internet.
Yes!
All right, Ken. Well, we will speak on Wednesday about the offense.